Hi, everybody. Indeed, from the land of 7,107 islands, not all of them obviously populated, some of them, incidentally, for sale if you want to buy an island. I am Art Bell, and we've got Howard Bloom here. And in a moment, we're going to sort of change directions a little bit to what the show was originally going to be about, and that is NASA and, of course, energy. That fits right into it, the whole energy thing. And when I get back, I'll read this second story in the latest five-minute Associated Press flurry of bad news. And it really is bad news. So, Howard Bloom, NASA and energy in a moment. Once again, the second big news story in this hour's Associated Press is all about our Alaskan oil fields shutting down. That's right, shutting down Anchorage. In a sudden blow to the nation's oil supply, half of the production on Alaska's North Slope was being shut down Sunday after BP Exploration Alaska Inc. discovered severe corrosion in a Prudhoe Bay oil transit line, BP officials say. They had no idea how long the Prudhoe Bay field would be offline. One said, "I don't even know how long it's going to take to shut it down." That's Tom Williams, BP's senior tax and royalty counsel. So let's move a little bit in topic. And Howard, you say that you've got sources at NASA and the National Science Foundation that say that NASA and the space program are hemorrhaging blood and likely to die if their wounds are not tended to. Explain.
Quite true, even though it sounds extreme when you contrast it with the kind of stuff we've been talking about up until now. And the connection to energy is right up front. 3 years ago, you and I spoke about this about 4 months ago. 3 years ago, a friend of mine at the National Science Foundation began hammering away at me week after week after week, trying to convince me of two things, that biofuels, that is methane and ethanol, are viable, that we can replace our gasoline with methane and ethanol, and I didn't believe him. And he tried to convince me of yet another thing, that we could get unending amounts of power from space, space solar power. And again, I didn't believe him. Then I found out, thanks probably to the good work of people like Vinod Khosla, the people who are pushing the biofuels movement these days, that there are 5 million cars on the road that are biofuels capable, that they run off of methane and ethanol. Now, what's the advantage of running off of methane and ethanol? Methane and ethanol can be made from corn husks. Right now, we're making them from corn. That's a silly idea. You can make them from any kind of waste or refuse. They can be made from sawgrass. They can be made from sawdust. And there's a company that's working on turning the stuff that you and I defecate into ethanol and methanol as well.
Right.
So this is a source that's right here in America. And the more ethanol and methanol we produce here in America, the more jobs we produce in America. And it's time for us to stop hemorrhaging blood economically. It's time for us to stop being a hostage to a set of oil-producing countries that hate our guts. Now, so we've got 5 million cars already on the road that they're called flex-fuel vehicles.
Right.
You don't know. If you've got one, you don't know. Your dealer has never told you that you have one. They've been produced in order to pull off a fast one on the government. The government requires that our major automakers decrease or increase the mileage of their cars each year. That's the CAFE standards.
Right.
And since, in fact, our cars have been getting bigger and bigger, they're going from SUVs to gigantic trucks. Why a normal family needs to drive a truck is beyond me. But at any rate, the gas mileage has actually been going down. But you get special credits toward your CAFE standards if you turn out cars that will operate on alternative fuels. Now, you don't have to tell your customers they've got cars that operate on alternative fuels. You simply have to produce them in order to satisfy the government requirement. And that's what Chrysler, GM, and Ford have been doing. The result is 5 million flex fuel vehicles. What is a flex fuel vehicle? It has a sensor and a microprocessor. And the sensor and the microprocessor determine exactly what mix of gasoline, ethanol, You can't use methanol on these things yet. But what precise mixture of gasoline and ethanol you have, what's the value of that? Well, these cars were developed by Ford for Brazil. Brazil, ever since the days of dictatorship about 30 or 40 years ago, has been aiming at an all-alcohol economy. That is an all-biofuels economy.
They're almost there, aren't they?
Yes, they are very close. Somewhere between 40 and 70% of their total transportation fuel supply comes from biofuels. And the biofuels didn't really take off there. It was slowly growing. But then all of a sudden it hit a takeoff point because Ford invented something amazing, the biofuels, that is the flex fuel vehicle. And the flex fuel vehicle means that if you stop in Brazil on a roadway and the gas station you roll up to has nothing but gasoline, fill your tank with gas, don't worry. The sensor and the microchip will determine exactly what mix of gasoline and ethanol you've got. If the next station you arrive at when you're empty is an ethanol station, so be it. Fill it up with ethanol, the engine will take care of the mix.
That's amazing.
Yes, and those cars are being sold now in the United States. Now, in the word of Fortune magazine is that in Brazil, they are selling like iPods.
Let me tell you, I'm seeing them here in the Philippines as well.
Really?
Fuel vehicle. Yeah, it's actually written right on the side of some of the vehicles.
I'm amazing. Beginning to see them. Well, how can we be so stupid, Art, as to not keep up with the folks in the Philippines?
I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of them, but I have seen them.
Ford, GM, and Chrysler are already turning out 36 different models of flex fuel vehicles. And it turns out that there are 72 companies with 93 plants that are already turning out 4.3 billion, with a B, gallons of biofuel per year. And there are another 2 billion gallons about to come online. Now, if that isn't an instant start to energy independence, nothing is. So there's another parallel story. There's a chapter in my book, The Lucifer Principle, A Scientific Expedition into the Forces of History, that basically says we have to do everything in our power to understand why we make war, so that we stop making war, so that eventually somehow we achieve Isaiah's vision of turning our swords into plows and our spears into pruning hooks. But we haven't gotten there yet, and as many understandings as The Lucifer Principle tries to throw at you, and as many understandings as Global Brain, my second book, tries to give you as to why we are so violent and how we can get out of it, it isn't enough. And I know we're not going to stop war while I'm still alive. But it says in this one chapter of The Lucifer Principle, because we're not going to be able to stop war during our lifetimes, and because war has become so dangerous in a nuclear age, especially a nuclear age where nuclear is going retail, if we don't get off this planet and put a bit of our species someplace else, we may extinguish our species utterly.
There are a lot of people who think that the reason that officially we have not heard from others is because they tend to, when they get to about the stage we're at now, blow themselves up.
And yes, it is a theory.
It's a reasonable hypothesis, actually.
Right.
Help me out here. Again, with NASA, you're suggesting we need to get going in space, and of course we're sort of going backwards right now. Are we really in that dangerous a time with NASA? In other words, are they really in that much trouble?
Well, they are, because the people that I've been in contact with, first of all, to give you a little bit more of the story.
Now, these are people you cannot name, right?
No, I don't want to name them at all. But I was asked to contribute the chapter that I just told you about to a book called Beyond Earth. And it was being put together by the Aerospace Technologies Working Group. And I became a member of this group thinking that it was a group of rocket enthusiasts, rocket hobbyists. I was wrong. It was a group that was founded in 1989 by NASA. And all of a sudden, I was in the midst of NASA people. One of NASA's people had an epiphany, a conversion, approximately 6 weeks ago. And suddenly, space solar power, which had seemed virtually impossible, he saw as not only possible, but very easily realizable, and not easily, but something that can be realized and something that's absolutely necessary for America. Absolutely necessary for America. And he converted me to this vision. Now, there's an important thing to keep in mind here. Why is Islam right now such a threat? because of the power of ideas. Because Muhammad's ideas have held a people together that goes all the way from Algeria to Aceh in Indonesia.
Right.
For close to 1,400 years. And it is said in Proverbs that without a vision, the people will perish. And in the United States, I don't think we see our way. I don't think we see ourselves as on the way to some new vast frontier that will open up, and in the process of of our opening it, will benefit all of humanity.
Now, since President Kennedy directed us to go to the moon,
right,
we really have not had a vision, honestly, Howard. And I felt that was a big mistake for America. America has always operated itself on visions, on plans for the future. And
exactly.
I'm in agreement with you. I think that power from space is eminently doable. Now, the plan I've always heard features a satellite in geosynchronous orbit.
Right.
Collecting vast amounts of solar energy very efficiently, of course,
right,
in space, and then returning it to Earth with microwave.
Which is very similar to what Tesla, who is in the current issue of After Dark magazine,
mm-hmm,
was doing. Broadcasting microwaves, broadcasting electricity.
That's right.
And the conversion rate of that microwave back to electricity is 78%, which is a very, very
good,
high conversion rate.
Pretty damn good, yes.
Now, what one of my friends from NSF has been doing is funding a lot of the technologies that are needed for space solar power. Specifically, if you send one satellite up and it unfurls its great vast arrays, because they fold up like fans, they're fairly easy to carry, and you send another one up and another one up and another one up and another one up, he's been funding robotic intelligences that will allow all of these assemblies to hook up together. But then I said to my friends in the space community a few weeks ago, it's not a good idea to have one central source of anything. That can always be knocked out of the sky. Wouldn't it be better if Minneapolis had its own space solar power satellite, if the fans of the Brooklyn Dodgers, they don't exist anymore, but if the fan of the Oakland Dodgers had their own space solar power satellite up in space? In other words, if many independent groups could have their own space solar power satellites, so that, like the Internet, it's a vastly distributed form of ownership.
The grid can be fed here on Earth.
Right. And my friends in the space community all said, yes, it's eminently possible. Now, I've been trying to basically take the temperature of the people in the space community and see what kind of a vision comes out of what they really want more than anything else. And I put a four-part plan together, again, because we have to have a long-term vision of where we're going and why. Step one is biofuels to carry us over for the next 17 to 20 years until we're really able to get a lot of stuff going in space.
Yeah, we do need a buffer.
Right. Space solar, because we won't be able to afford space if we keep spending our money on oil like this. Nor will you and I have the spirit to continue if we feel that we're constantly like the head of a mop that's being swished around by somebody who has a handle on us. And that's the way we're being treated these days. The second step is space solar power. The third step is mining the moon and the asteroids. There are people who, when you go to these conventions, I'm at my third space convention in the last 6 weeks. I'm sitting here in a hotel room in Washington, D.C., overlooking the Potomac River and overlooking the airport, which is off in the distance on its own island. It's a lovely view. But the point is that there are people at these sessions, every single one of them, who point out exactly what the prices are of platinum and titanium, how much platinum and titanium there is in asteroids, and how much we can bring back to Earth and how much it would be worth and what a profit we'd make. But that's
Howard, I could not be in more agreement with you, but, you know, the view that you just described actually is comprised of the exact people that have to be convinced. The people at NASA, the scientists, they're probably, for the most part, all for this. I'm sure they're all for it. They realize the reasonable aspects of getting power from space. It's not NASA you've got to convince. It's the people in that view in front of you right now.
That's right. And so what I've been doing is I've been traveling across the country, meeting with the people in the space community, trying to get a consensus vision. By the way, step four is Mars. Step four is one of your periodic guests, Robert Zubrin's vision of how to colonize Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. We have to get a vision across to the public. But first, I have to pull together a consensus. It doesn't have to be me. Somebody else could do it, but the only one who's doing it right now is me. And I want to pull together a consensus vision And once we have that consensus vision, then determine how to get together a public relations structure that can carry that vision across to the American people. You know that I spent 20 years doing field work in pop culture. And 15 of those years, as odd as it is for a person who listened to Bartosz, Stravinsky, Beethoven, and Mozart to become a leading figure in the rock and roll world, I ran the largest PR firm in the record industry. You know, working with Michael Jackson, Prince, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, AC/DC, right. Aerosmith, Kiss, all, you know, many, many others, Paul Simon, Billy Joel. Well, I did that for a reason, Art. As a kid who's been into science since the age of 10, that means I've been into science now for 53 years, more than a half a century. Why would I get involved in a form of music that I didn't know anything about? Because I wanted to get under the belly of the beast. I wanted to get into the dark heart where myths are made. I wanted to get into the sense of public passions that makes an Islam happen, that makes a Hitler happen, and that should and that made that brought the West to its finest moment in World War II when the West was about to lose everything. And it did it under Winston Churchill and FDR. Those men knew how to rouse the finest forces in all of us and make and change history in their time. And believe me, they were just as fragile as you and me. And my task over the last 50 years has been to find out, using all the tools of my science, how to do that so that when the moment came when I could possibly have an influence of any kind, no matter how subsidiary, I could do my best to do what Winston Churchill had done, what FDR had done, and what many people whose names we will never know have done. And that has helped pull us out of a crisis. And we are in a moment of crisis. And part of that crisis is we do not have a vision, as you pointed out, and we desperately need one.
Okay, Howard. Well, it's the politicians that you're going to have to convince, or either that or through a grassroots effort, convince politicians. One way or the other, you've got to convince politicians. And they're worried about what's going on here on Earth right now. And, of course, there's a big sentiment. Look, we've got a lot of poverty. We've got a lot of troubles with a planet that's now obviously heating up. We've got... All kinds of earthly problems. Why in the world do we want to spend any money at all on space when we've got all this going on down here? That's
because
going to be a tough sell.
Because there's an unending amount of energy up there. It will, not in the immediate, in the short run, but in the long run, it will alleviate these problems tremendously. Also, why is there so much strife in this tiny, tiny piece of territory called the Middle East? The part that centers around Israel is a squidgen. It's the size of Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
For God's sakes. I mean, it's a nothing. Why is there so much tension about it? Well, once upon a time, Germany or England and France spent 100 years making war with each other because England wanted to take more territory, and the only territory it could imagine taking was in France. So every few years, England would send an army over to France, try to carve out as much of the country as it could, and then go home. This never stopped. It went 100 years is a long time, five generations. What stopped it was when suddenly this new land that was as new as a new planet opened up to the English. It was called the Americas. And instead of training their eyes for territory on France, they were able to train their eyes on North America. When they started to open up North America, taking pieces of France became irrelevant to them. In other words, we have a crowding problem. We need more real estate. And there is a lot of real estate on Mars. It's not easy to pioneer it. It's not easy to homestead it, but it's there to be homesteaded. It's there for mankind to harvest, and it's there for mankind to do something on behalf of all of life.
Well, on behalf of all of life. So when you're suggesting all of this, you're really being very negative on mankind's chances of survival on this planet. You're almost saying to yourself and to all of us that, look, we are going to destroy ourselves. So if you really want humanity to continue in some form, you're going to have to colonize the moon and Mars and beyond, or humanity simply will cease to exist. It's a pretty negative view.
Well, actually, what I try to do with my books is give you so many insights that you can help solve the problem, that you can take the solution of the problem of war a step forward, that your children can take it a step forward beyond you, and that their children can take it a step forward beyond them. But that's a long process. And meanwhile,
Boy,
we have Lebanon.
I sure hope we have that many generations left. All right, Howard, hold tight. We're here at the bottom of the hour. And one question that Howard asked, why is there so much trouble in such a little tiny speck of, relatively tiny speck of land, meaning Israel in the Middle East? I don't know. All of history tells us why, if we simply look at all of history. From 7,107 islands, I'm Art Bell. Hi, everybody. Howard Bloom is my guest, and we're discussing, well, actually a range of issues from what's going on in the Middle East right now, which does really bear directly on the space program, because it's all related to energy. And Howard's suggesting there's a very great deal of trouble with the space program, and there ought not to be, because actually, in a lot of ways, down the line away, it'll be our savior, or could be our savior, unless we cave into the argument that we have so many troubles here on Earth that we simply can't pay attention to space. And then there's, the greater argument that if we don't pay attention to space, there will not be any humans left to carry on. We'll be right back. Once again, here is Howard Bloom. Howard, welcome back. I'm going to take up kind of the next 30 minutes or so with you, and then we're going to turn you over to the audience. I'm sure
they're gonna feed me to the lions.
Great. Now, feed you to the lions is right. However, you've made an awful lot of sense to me. I have long been, what's the right word, a cautious proponent of power from space. There is one thing that I've been concerned about, and that, of course, is the safety aspect of it. If you beam microwave energy in mass back to Earth and you have a spacecraft that wanders a little bit, you damn well better have a very, very, very secure method of keeping it where it is, or shutting it off if it begins to wander. Otherwise, you could cook a trail as it moves.
Well, that's, I've been very concerned about that. And I have been told over and over again that the transmission methods, there are two different transmission methods. One is a light-to-light laser, which is being funded by one of my friends at NSF. And the other is microwave. And I've been told that microwaves coming through the air are no more of the kind that we're talking about, are no more harmful to you and me than radio waves. Now, we've been living with radio waves ever since we were born. There were 600 radio stations licensed in 1922.
Right.
That's long before you and I came around, and we did not come out as mutants.
No, I don't quite buy that.
I don't either. I won't believe it until I really, really, really see it. But as you can tell, right now we're pulling a lot of things together. Space solar power is not something that the space community is universally behind. In fact, far from it. There are a lot of people in the space community who oppose space solar power because they have their own agendas, and there's only a limited amount of money to go around.
Right.
One of the things that I'm doing is Condoleezza Rice-style shuttle diplomacy, trying to get the members of the space community to work together, whether there's time for that, given my constraints, having to work on book deadlines and things like that. We'll have to see. But so far, I'm doing my best with it. We'll see what happens. And as for why NASA is hemorrhaging, it's because a year ago, almost precisely a year ago, the Chinese put two men into space. And that prodded George Bush. George basically brought in his wise men and said, I need a vision for space. Now, when we talk about without a vision, the people will perish, we're not talking about something stale and dry that's on a piece of paper. We're talking about something vibrant and living and passionate.
But he needs a funded vision.
He needs that's another problem with George Bush. What he proclaims he will do is not what he funds. But in this case, the vision that they came up with was something that made my heart sink. And we've talked about this before. It was the CEV and CLV program.
And you don't like it. And you said there's a lot of unhappiness with the crew exploration vehicle and the crew launch vehicle.
There's a tremendous amount of unhappiness because, Art, have you seen the pictures? You must have by now.
I have seen pictures. Obviously, the shuttle is almost history. I mean,
right.
It's very old. We have to move on to whatever's next.
Right.
And, you know, why is there so much unhappiness with it?
Because what's next is a repeat of the Apollo program. What's next, when you put together a mission that's going to cost $14 to $17 billion a year, and it's something that literally looks up at the sky, that literally reaches toward the stars, that literally can provide a beacon of light, you are talking about something that has to make the human spirit resonate. And I hate to sound so evangelical about something like space and technology, but this is about spirit. It is about soul. And Bush, unfortunately, and his minions were tone deaf to the human spirit. So what they did is circulated a bunch of pictures of vehicles that could only take us up to the moon to make footprints on the moon and put another one of those flags up there. And that says to you and me, your best years, America, were in 1969. Your best years are in the past. A program of this kind has to say your best years are in the future. Now, to achieve this program, which even Mike Griffin, the head of NASA, calls Apollo on steroids. In other words, he's aware of the fact that it's an Apollo repetition.
Yeah.
And that's all it is. They've been cutting budgets for all kinds of other things. So one friend, one of my recent friends from this round of trips I've been making to the space conventions at NASA, said, I used to tell people that my job at NASA was thinking big ideas. They gave me a title last week that doesn't allow me to say that anymore. Another person who's done some remarkably innovative things at NASA said, NASA is in a state of paralysis because of the space industrial complex. I can't take it anymore. I'm leaving at the end of the month. Then when I had lunch with him 2 days ago here in Washington, he said, please don't tell anybody that I said I'm leaving in a month because I haven't told my NASA teammates yet.
All right.
And this kind of discontent is all over NASA. It's because no one wants to put up throwaway billion-dollar tin cans, and that's what these things are. They're not reusable vehicles for the most part. And nobody wants to simply repeat Apollo. People want to do things that take them into new frontiers technologically,
sure,
that excite them. So does,
sure,
the American public. Plus, Bush is only in office for another 2 years, and you are very right. Whoever follows him as president may very well say, why are we wasting all of this money in space, especially if there is no exciting vision in space for us in space whatsoever?
Well, I think you're on the right track with energy, Howard. Honestly, I do. I have a friend right now, actually he's been a friend for a long time, he's going to be on the program with me next week, who's got a private space effort going. But in terms of a national, look, we can do this kind of deal, we can make ourselves at least well on the road toward energy independence kind of drive. Something short of that is just not going to be a vision for the American people. And minus a vision for another 30 years, we're in deep doo-doo.
I agree with you totally. And you couldn't have said it better. You put it much more succinctly than I can. Now, you talked about, I call them the billionauts. These are the little guys. NASA's opening up a tiny little spigot of budget for little guys, for the industry people. It's opening up something called the Commercial Orbital Transportation Demonstrations Program. Mm-hmm. And we've got something coming up, Art, that's pretty dire. In 2010, we're supposed to retire the space shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get a new vehicle until 2014. For 4 years, America, which is supposed to be the leading country in the world, doesn't have access to space. And India has access to space, and China has access to space, and even Israel has access to space, but not the United States of America.
You, of course, refer to manned access.
Yes, manned access.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's like slicing my tendons. There was serious consideration of not repairing Hubble. That's like taking out my eye, for God's sakes. And I'm speaking not just about me and my selfish desires. I'm speaking about hundreds of millions of other people. There is an insensitivity to our dreams right now in NASA that is chilling and killing. And it is driving people out. And it cannot do that. For $17 billion, give me vision.
Well, I think it's a job of our leaders to provide vision, to provide actual leadership. I don't blame them entirely because the American public, Howard, has itself been lacking vision. And I'm not referring, for the most part, to listeners to this program, because obviously they've got a lot of vision. You know, they're into this kind of subject matter, and they have that vision. But by and large, the American public sort of gave up on space and said, look, let's spend the money at home. We need it at home. And that, you know, that the politicians heard that, and it made it easy for them to do it. Now,
what do you think caused that? The Challenger disaster, the two...
That was part of it.
Because you don't give up in the face of failure.
I think that we have insufficiently explained to the American people the benefits of a robust space program.
Right.
You know, they say Teflon and a few other things they throw out that came from space research. Actually, there was a very great deal that came from the research that got us to the moon, Howard. There was a whole lot that came out of it. But we don't talk about that. It's just not a big deal. And it became sort of politically unpopular to be in favor of a robust space program. So it just died away.
Well, one of the people from NASA that I spent a lot of time with over the last 2 days said something to the following effect. You can offer a person as much money to die as you want, and he will not take the money. But you offer him an idea, and he will live and die for it. And that, again, is, I mean, you're right. I don't think that the vision of space has been, that its truth has been adequately sold to the American public. I don't
think
that the people at NASA who are currently in charge understand that truth, the emotional truth of going into space, what it means for humanity, what it means for all of life. Life is a process. This planet has gone through 146 mass extinctions. Al Gore's movie is right. We are headed for a climatic catastrophe one way or the other, but it doesn't have anything to do with our smokestack factories.
Howard, listen, we're not going to sell the American people on the idea of a space program by saying it's the only way we're going to save some small last vestige of humanity. We're not going to sell it that way. The way we probably can sell it, though, is by selling the idea of energy, solar energy transmitted to Earth. I think that's got serious possibilities.
Right. And then what do you think of the solar tour or the space tourism aspect?
I think that that has serious possibilities. Robert Bigelow, as I mentioned, a good friend of mine, will be on next week.
Very
interesting. He's had a successful launch.
Yes, and I met him last week two weeks ago in Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's right. By God, Howard, he's going to get a hotel up there.
And he's got cockroaches and moths up there living in his his inflatable structure. Its solar panels have deployed. It's
that's
a minor miracle. To allow cockroaches and moths to live may sound trivial, but it's not. It means that he's got a life-friendly environment within this inflatable thing. And he put this together by buying a bunch of NASA technology that NASA had abandoned.
Right.
And then developing his own patents. Now, he's one of just a bunch of people who are going after the funding for this COTS program, the Commercial Orbital Transportation Demonstrations Program.
Right.
The idea is, in those four blind years, when we have no way of getting humans into space, that private industry will take over. And we have a bunch of people who are underwriting this. Elon Musk, who made his billions with PayPal. John Carmack, who made his billions with Doom and Quake. Bob Bigelow, we just talked about. He used to own Budget Suites of America. Burt Rutan. And he doesn't have billions, but he created Spaceship One and has gotten Richard Branson to invest in it. And the list goes on. If we are saved during those 10 years of space blindness, of space incapability, it will be by virtue of the efforts of these men. And these are the men we have to look up to, and these are men who are going to be the heroes, I hope, of the next generation.
Well, God bless them. But how do we get the American people, not just this audience listening tonight, but the American people in mass, behind the idea of power from space? Certainly, we have no lack of headlines. I mean, tonight we find out that half our Alaskan oil is shutting down.
Right.
We've all watched the gas prices. We can all see the temperatures rising. We can all see the oil prices and gas prices rising. We can all see this happening. When will it come to a boiling point where, you know, this kind of idea is going to be a relatively easy sell? How do we do that?
It's going to take $1 million a year, which in space terms is small, but in ordinary human terms is large. It's going to take a staff of 7 to 9 people. It's going to take people doing what I used to call perceptual engineering when I was in the publicity business. And now, Art, for me, because I was in publicity not to make money. I was in publicity to learn what I could about making history. To me, perceptual engineering was taking a truth, a bone-deep truth that no one saw, and showing them how to see it, even if it meant taking them to lunch for 4 hours at a time for 3 years straight before they saw it, eventually getting them to see it. And the space program needs that, but first the space program has to have something exciting about it. And, of course, space solar power is a key central point.
I'm not sure that it's going to require a manned space program. This is something that...
No, it's robotic. That's robotic.
Right.
But you will need to have humans to service the thing. And it's a good reason to get humans into space.
Yeah. Have you looked at all into the space elevator concept?
The space elevator concept seems too unlikely to happen to me. I would gladly be into it, but I don't see any signs of it really producing any results. Rocketry, we already know, even though it's an old technology. I mean, you know, Robert Goddard was fooling around with liquid-fueled rockets in the 1930s.
Right.
But with rockets, we can do this. And not only that, Bob Bigelow can put up his hotels. I was suggesting that Bob Bigelow put up his hotels by the space station. The International Space Station is an utterly worthless piece of junk, but it becomes useful as a tourist attraction. It becomes useful as something people can go see as the biggest boondoggle in the history of mankind.
God, that's... I'm sure there's lots of other attractive reasons that we can offer. You're suggesting the hotel go up near it just
so
you can see the biggest, most expensive boondoggle that man has ever hoisted into space.
Yes, pretty much. I mean, people would be curious. They go to see the Titanic. That was one of the most expensive wrecks we've ever seen, too.
Yeah. Is it really that dim for the International Space Station? I mean, where are we with that, by the way?
Nobody sees any real use in it except a small amount of research on what happens to humans if they spend a long time in space. But frankly, a lot of that research was done on Mir, which was a real functioning space station. And the budgets for this kind of research, Art, have been cut. Here we have an International Space Station, and the final and the last few budgets that had anything to do with any science that would help us get further into space are gone. Now, Burt Rutan, who is the winner of the X Prize, the most brilliant creator of airships of our time, Burt Rutan, at one of these conventions that I've been attending, said, if I were Mike Griffin, in other words, the head of NASA, and I were given the instructions that Mike Griffin has been given, I would do exactly what Mike Griffin has done. Then I would call a press conference. When all of the press was assembled, I would walk up to the microphone. I would grab it. I would say, "This is stupid!" And I'd go back to my office to work.
At least for 10 minutes before you were dismissed.
Right, exactly. So, yes, I agree with you totally. We need vision. I agree with you totally that solar power is a very good way to get it. It literally is a beacon in the sky, and we humans are attracted to light and energy, and we're attracted to things that are high above us. Those represent our aspirations, our dreams, our stepping stones to the future for generations to come. How do we sell it? We need a team. We need money. Whether those things will materialize, I have yet to see, but the one thing that I did trigger at the convention I was at last week was a promise to sponsor a seminar with the leading scientists in the world on space solar power today to see where the concepts of space solar power are, what can be done to implement it, given the fact that we've got brand new technologies that weren't available the last time space solar power was being evaluated 30 years ago. So that
well,
at least I've been
reasonably convinced that, that enough safety could be put in place, sort of a redundant backup safety business, so that if this thing got off target, if a satellite were to drift, it would automatically shut off. I've been kind of convinced that that part of it we may have enough technology now so that it could be safely done. And if it could, there isn't just a virtually unlimited amount of power that could come from space and in a relatively small area be collected and then distributed here on Earth. And if that's not enough reason to go to space, looking at today's headlines, I don't know what is.
We need new real estate. It's hanging above our heads, just waiting to be grasped. And we have
no, you're absolutely correct. I just can't figure out how we fire the American people up.
Well, my wife likes to say that when China gets there, we'll want to get there too. And China and India are working on it. In fact, China and India are negotiating with some of the space solar power people that I've been spending my time with over the last few weeks.
But there has got to be a better reason to go to space than to beat the other guy. And that's the only thing that really got us there before.
Well,
frankly,
that got us there before. We're not doing this because it's easy. We're doing it because it's hard, said John F. Kennedy. And what he didn't put in is we're doing it to beat the Russians.
Well, that's exactly why we did it. And then after we got finished, we weren't sure why we did it. And we certainly were not sure why we should continue it. And so, of course, we did not. And many of those boosters are still laid to waste. Hold on, Howard. When we come back, we'll go to the phones, whether you want to talk about what's going on in the Middle East or you want to talk about what ought to be going on above our heads. And the two are related. Either way, you're welcome. You know the phone numbers, so come talk to Howard Bloom. I'm Art Bell. From the land of 7,107 islands in Southeast Asia, the Philippines, we'll be right back.